The kind of fruit the Spirit produces in our lives. What is it? Love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. Anybody committed it to memory yet? Let's have a look. There's value in that. And I know 9 seems like a lot, but it's just 3 sets of 3. And we're working on that first set of 3 at the moment. And last week we were looking at that first fruit of the Spirit's work in our life, which is love. And love, well, love, as we said, is foundational. Love is foundational. And what can you do on a foundation? Build. Yeah? You can't really live on a foundation, but you can build on a foundation. And without the foundation, building is in vain. Love is absolutely foundational. I was also thinking, as often happens, of something that I probably should have said last week. Any philosophers here? No philosophers here. They don't teach philosophy at school in Scotland, which I think is a shame, because it's kind of important. And the old philosopher René Descartes said, "I think, therefore I am." For the Latin guys among you, ergo cogito sum. I hope I've got that right. Hopefully none of you have done Latin, so you can't tell me I've got that wrong. But I think, therefore I am. I think, therefore I am. The thing is that that's not quite faithful to the Christian tradition in which he was. Descartes was a believer, great mathematician too. This, I think, is the foundational philosophical statement of the Christian faith. I am loved, therefore I am. Yeah? I'm loved. When you think about that, a kid who's loved, really loved, what difference does it make to that kid? Just makes all the difference in the world. Well, how do we know that? Because we were all kids, weren't we? And being loved roots us firm on the ground, gives us a solid foundation from which to build. I was talking with someone recently who said that they didn't know anything but a kind of conditional love. They only got approval if they did well. One of the key things when they first came to faith was understanding that God's love isn't like that. We're loved by grace, and then anything that happens after that is a result of that. It flows from it. We don't do it to earn. It's a foundation upon which we build. Do you understand? And it's important when we're raising our children that we're mindful that we don't fall into that trap. We have to incentivize good behavior on occasion, or there will be mayhem in our houses. But ultimately, the most important thing we can give a kid is that notion that they're loved. And if we have that notion that we're loved, then what flows from that? Joy? Okay. Any of you guys fallen in love? Okay, you fall in love. And what's the outflow of that, if it really gets you? It's joy. Yeah? You don't fall in love and think, oh, this is going to be a hang load of work. Do you? Well, I don't know, actually. This church is made up of lots of different strokes, and maybe that is your first thought, is you're sort of planning the wedding and planning, you know. But the outflow of being loved is joy. And we've got to look at joy today. Just to get you in that place, though, I want you to think, and it may be related to that previous question, but I want you to think of a moment in your life of pure joy. You got one?
Yeah.
You got one? What sort of things are bubbling to the surface? Yvette's smiling. I think it might be knitting. Yes, Kath. Being alive and finished and concentrate. But... oh, yeah. Isn't it? I'm sure the oncology department, you're delighted they're there, and you're absolutely even more delighted to say, bye. Flowers, chocolate, sayonara. Okay. Anything else? Yes, Richard. Birthday tomorrow, you're going to be 45. That gives you joy. Birthdays and your mom. Brilliant. All your family. Spot on. Oh, the church family too. Excellent. Thank you, Richard. What other things bring people joy? Yeah, come on, Liam. Holding your daughter for the first time. Oh, hey. Closely followed by tech? No. Holding your daughter for the first time. It's a different sort of joy, right? Brilliant. Was that a hand up fee? Oh, come on. Check. Having four great grandchildren. I thought you said 48 grandchildren. Four great grandchildren. Brilliant. Yep. All sorts of things bring us joy, yeah? All sorts of things. Some sort of sporting achievement or a good setting, a good fitting set of false teeth. I'm sure that brings a great amount of joy. It's not. False teeth are great if you've run out of your own. So, what other things sort of was spoken about? Yes, Fee. Your garden. There was a program on Radio 4 recently that said that they've discovered that soil contains antidepressants. There's a substance in soil that will lift your mood. And there's an odor released by trees which does exactly the same. So if you're feeling a bit blue, grab yourself a shovel and dig a hole in your local forest. You might arouse suspicion. There you go, the garden. So, these moments will bring us great joy, yeah? Wedding day, your kids arriving, getting a job, getting a qualification you've worked really hard for, landing something that was unlikely. You know, the first time you've seen something you've written in print or some music you've made on a CD or a download or something, or just a really lovely outfit, yeah? Something like that. Moments of pure joy. Relational stuff, seeing someone you haven't seen in a while. I remember some good friends of ours. He was a really strong Christian. He married this lass from Lancashire before she became a Christian. And there were rumors kept going around that she'd become a Christian. So three or four times I said to her, "Hey, Sue, delighted to hear you become a Christian." And she said, "I haven't." She was from Lancashire. She was very honest. Right? "No, haven't." "Really? Oh, I thought you had." "Oh, great to hear you become a Christian." "Yeah." "No, I haven't yet." And then eventually when she did, I kind of picked her up and brawled her around. Did the same to my mother-in-law too. So, moments of pure joy. And those of you who served on Alpha will know all about that. Yes, John? Being back with someone you love the most. Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. So, I'll tell you what, I experienced some joy when Andrew Dunsire dropped this in my inbox. Thank you very much, Andrew. Because as soon as I looked at this, I went, of course, this is about a tree bearing fruit, isn't it? Oh my goodness me, good fruit. Does that nudge you in the shoulder, you know, dig you in the ribs about another biblical story about a tree with fruit? Yeah? And right there at the start of Genesis 1, you have this story of a tree in the center of the garden. I was listening to the recent podcast by Tim Mackey and John Collins on the Bible Project, looking at God's generosity, they were talking about this. And they're beautifully honest. And John's like, I've always wondered, why was the tree in the middle of the garden? You know, why not put that tree off to one side so you could sort of ignore it? It's right in the middle of the garden. And Tim Mackey said, oh, that's a really good question. I'm not sure. My current thinking on this is that maybe it's to do with the fact that every time we make a decision as a human being, there's always the temptation to do it sort of in our own strength, to define right and wrong for ourselves. And I think that that's true, that we face those choices, don't we? And then they ask this question, which is a kind of drop the microphone sort of question. How many bad choices would it take to ruin my life completely? How many bad choices would it take to ruin my life completely? And so here we're talking about the fruit of the Spirit, which is a good thing, and it speaks of well, we'll get onto that later, okay? We'll come back to this idea, but this idea of fruit has strong biblical connotations, of which, of course, Paul was very much aware. Indeed, at the campfire, he could probably read you the first chapters of Genesis off by heart without the text in front of him. So last week, do you remember, we had a look at, I got you to think about your favorite Bible passages with the word love in them, and I would outsource that again, but it takes a wee while. You might be thinking about some. We've encountered some today already. This is the sort of King James English Standard Version translation. It's not the NLT, because I prefer this one, because this is the one I know. Okay, this is the one I've memorized. From Psalm 16, verse 11. Read it with me. In his presence there is fullness of joy. Oh my goodness me. So as we're looking at cultivating joy in our lives, being in God's presence, yeah? Being in God's presence. Being in God's presence. Every now and then I come across people who will tell the story of having fallen away from their faith. And a remarkable number of them report a similar story, is that at their lowest they said, do you know what, God, I don't believe in you. And what they don't realize at that point is that they're actually quoting the scriptures. If you read through something like Psalm 88, there's it's kind of like, God, where are you? There's, in other words, you don't exist. Bad people are prospering. The good people are suffering. Life is topsy-turvy. Everything's crooked. Your promises are not coming through. And I say the same thing to everybody that I encounter who has this. I say, isn't that remarkable? Is that your lowest ebb, you were praying. Like, I'm like, what? You were praying. You were talking to God. If you say, God, I don't believe you exist, why are you bothering telling him if he's not there? And it's because we have an innate, inbuilt sense that in his presence, good things happen. Yeah? It's extraordinary to me that you could listen to somebody, say, like a Richard Dawkins or a Stephen Fry, and they will talk about the fact that there can't be a God because there's so much suffering in the world, which means, at root, they're saying God is good. Why do they have anything to say about God if they don't believe he exists? I mean, it should not, it's not an argument. God might be capricious and a bit evil, might be like the Greek gods who had bad days. And so, in his presence, there is fullness of joy. That gives us something to stand on, even if our feelings aren't playing ball, all right? Even if our feelings aren't playing ball. Even if we're in a dark and lonely place. And I'll say, well, what does that, and this is not exhaustive, you could put it in other ways, but what does that verse in that psalm communicate to me? And it communicates this, that there's, joy is about delight. You know that thing where you just look at your kid playing, or you look at an amazing landscape, or you see something that somebody's created, and there's just that kind of, wow, that's amazing. Or you eat great food. Yeah. Delight. So the first thing I want to draw out of our look at joy today is it's about delight. There's going to be four things, by the way, just in case you... Okay, so you need four boxes to put this in. The first is from Psalm 16:11. In His presence there's fullness of joy. It's about delight. Here's the second scriptural passage that I started to think about, and this one's a really tender one. You might remember, you remember Jacob? The guy whose name means cheat. And yet Jacob is the one who God gives the name Israel to, and from that all the promises given to Abraham flow out. And to us, we receive the promises in Jesus the Messiah because of God's faithfulness to Abraham and his descendants. And Jacob goes to Uncle Laban's because he's ticked off his brother Esau by cheating him out of his inheritance. He's had in cahoots with his mom. He gets the blessing from his blind dad by, you know, because it's a great Bible verse to memorize. My brother Esau is a hairy man, but I am a smooth man. So mom dresses him up in a goat skin, and Isaac is kind of like, oh, you kind of smell like Jacob, but you feel like Esau. So yeah, I'll give you my blessing, and he runs off with the inheritance, and then has to run off because, of course, Esau, being a big hairy guy, is about to knock Jacob's lights out. Though Esau was stupid enough to give away his inheritance for lunch, but there you go. And he runs off to Uncle Laban's, and he falls in love with Rachel, but on his wedding night, he gets Leah, because the older sister's to be married off first. And so, tricky cheating Jacob is outdone by tricky cheating Uncle Laban. And I'm telling you, if you try and get ahead in this life by backhanding, underhanded stuff, guess who's watching? And that boomerang is going to come right back and hit you in the forehead. I'm just saying. I can't say how, but it will. You cannot pull a fast one on God. He's very good at poker. Okay. He knows your give. You can't bluff him because he can see your cards. Right. So, here we have Leah, who up to this point has been childless and set to one side. Her life is so constricted and confined. And then in Genesis 30, God gives Leah a son who she calls Asher. What joy is mine, says Leah. Now the other woman will celebrate with me. Asher means blessed. Asher means blessed. And here in this incredible story, we discover that another aspect of joy, if Psalm 16 talks about delight that we find in the Lord's presence, here's the next thing that's wrapped up in joy, is that deep sense of gratitude. Counting our blessings, giving thanks, properly giving thanks, properly giving thanks. I was listening to a speaker who said he goes to universities, but he taught at an Ivy League university. And some of the students who were there were grumbling about the oppression of this group or that group within the university. And he would say to them, you are at an Ivy League university. You know, I think it was Harvard, which is about 4,000 students. The possibilities that will fall in front of you in your life are unmatched in the history of the world. And you're grumbling that you're a victim? Really? I mean, you think about our nation at the moment. And we're going to look next week about, we might have a wee peek over worry. Is there anything anybody's worried about at the moment? You know, one of those terrible new words where you take Britain and exit and squish it together to make a new word. We'll maybe have a look at that next week. But we get awful concerned about stuff. Actually, we've got so much to give thanks for. Remember listening to a lady who moved to the Netherlands from an African country. And you know what she couldn't believe? She couldn't believe that the police were helpful. Because the country she came from, the police were corrupt. And you would avoid police on the street because they might grab you. They might stitch you up for something you hadn't done. They might beat you. They would almost certainly be getting backhanders from local gang lords. So you stayed away from the police. She moves to Rotterdam or wherever it was, and she's like, you can ask them for directions or the time, and they'll help you. I've got so much to be thankful for. A basic attitude of gratitude, that helps foster joy. So we've got delight and gratitude. Now we're getting to the, Ezra the scribe is pronouncing in Nehemiah 8, and he says this extraordinary phrase. What does he say? The joy of the Lord is my strength. Please, please, please commit this to memory. The joy of the Lord is my strength. Nehemiah 8:10. You might remember the walls of Jerusalem have been torn down, and Nehemiah has managed to persuade the emperor to allow the walls to be reestablished. A big deal, because as soon as there's walls around the city, that city can become a strategic threat. But that's not the end of it, because then Nehemiah has to take some folks with him and chat with the folks who were there and kind of get building the wall, and they kind of get off to a good start, and then they're kind of like, oof. And then there's Sanballat and Tobiah who show up and say, you don't want to be doing that. And so they're building with a kind of trowel in one hand and a sword in the other. Okay. So, the joy of the Lord is my strength. Can we just pause here for a moment? Whose joy is our strength? The Lord's, yeah. Oh, Jesus is Lord, amen. No, it's fine. Jesus is Lord. That'll do me fine. The joy of the Lord is our strength. How many of you spend any time meditating on God's joyfulness? I'm going to press pause. Inverse. How many of you are possessed of the thought that God must be awful worried and concerned about the troubles in the world because he, like, has been watching a 24-hour news cycle all over the world for all of human history? And it might have the same impact on him that it does on us. Those of you who are old enough to remember the evening news will remember that a bomb in Belfast and riots outside a pit head could not be assuaged with a skateboarding cat at the end of the news. It didn't really cheer you up. You just left the news with the sense that the world's in a mess. The joy of the Lord is my strength. Where does joy come from? Where does anxiety come from? Ooh. See, if you think about it, is God anxious about anything? In his presence, there is fullness of joy. The joy of the Lord is my strength. To be in God's presence is to be in the presence of the most joyful being there is ever or will ever be. Now, some of you are going, yes. And some of you are perhaps going, hang fire. There's bits of my life are really bad. And how dare God be having joy when my life is so tough? From which I would say, where is the outflow of grace and love, delight, gratitude going to come? It's going to come from him. That's a well that we do not want poisoned. Yes? The joy of the Lord is my strength. If you are going through tough times, joy is available regardless of circumstance. Regardless of circumstances. Because you don't have... things have to be going pretty well for you to be happy, right? Things do not have to be going well for you to experience joy. Because joy is that underneath sense that God has it, even though today it's really challenging. The joy of the Lord is my strength is a statement of warfare. Are things as they should be? No. Are we inside Eden or outside Eden? Outside. Inside the New Jerusalem or outside the New Jerusalem? Outside, okay? Where there's wailing and gnashing of teeth. Read your Bibles. Now, that is our reality. There's always something wrong, right? But where God's joy is set loose, good things start to happen. To trust in God in the midst of the crisis, to trust in God in the midst of the pain, to trust in God in the midst of the grief or the addiction or the difficulty, in the midst of the relational breakdown, in the midst of the sorrow or the redundancy, is an act of warfare against the enemy, your circumstances, and maybe even yourself. Do you hear me? To allow the joy of the Lord to rest in us is an act of warfare. Okay. So delight, gratitude, warfare. Now we get to Jesus. The writer to the Hebrews, we've been in this passage before this year. And I know it was one that Helen brought prophetically a while ago. And it just, there's this incredible passage at the beginning of Hebrews 12. Let us run with endurance the race that God has set before us. We do this by keeping our on. Yeah, who is innately joyful, right? The champion who initiates and perfects our faith. Because of the awaiting him, he endured the cross, disregarding its shame. Disregarding it. Friends, if we could learn this, so much in our lives would be more Christ-centered. Okay. There is a story of Smith Wigglesworth, the itinerant healing evangelist guy, that he once woke up in the middle of the night and there was a manifestation of the devil at the foot of his bed. Right? Yeah. To which Smith Wigglesworth said, "Oh, it's only you." Because the last thing Smith Wigglesworth said every night was, "Good night, Lord." And the first thing he said in the morning was, "Morning, Lord." You hear me? Psalm 23 puts it this way, "You have prepared a table in the presence of my enemies." And he's expecting you to enjoy the meal. That's his expectation. Jesus, in Gethsemane, he goes through Gethsemane and the cross, the betrayal, the cruelty, the horror, the shouldering up of everybody's sin and shame and brokenness and awfulness. He does that. And only once in that whole thing, quoting from Psalm 22, does he have any sense that he's maybe this is going to crush him? My God, why have you forsaken? And it's soon after that he's released from that. And then, as 2 Peter would have it, he goes for a wee Jet 2 holiday to hell. So you coming? Coming? Hi. Here to rescue you. Out you come. Out you come. And it drags him out. The ability to be in the presence of wickedness and trust in the goodness of God is an extraordinary thing. And it gives us something that we need in this world, yes? What does it give us? I think it gives us courage. I think it gives us courage. So, delight, gratitude, warfare, courage. These are things that you can draw out of what it means to be joyful. So how do we do it? How do we do it? Do we just go, "Oh, I'm going to be more joyful, I'm going to be more joyful, I'm going to be more joyful, I'm going to be more joyful. How come I'm more joyful than that miserable old punter over there and I'm now feeling more miserable?" Yeah? Oh boy, if earnestness could do it, it'd be done by now. Well, Paul goes on in Galatians 5 saying this, "If we live by the Spirit, let us also keep in step with the Spirit. Okay. Remember I said I was going to go back to that fruit story at the garden at the beginning? The fruit of the Spirit is the evidence of God's presence in our lives. Yeah? That's the overflow of it. But is that to do with God's action or ours? God's action or ours? God's action or ours? Who thinks it's God's action?
I do.
Okay, who thinks it's our action? Okay, anybody voting for anything else? Okay, let me explain. There's that wonderful promise to Noah after the flood that seed time and harvest will never again fail. So I want you to imagine you're all farmers, all right? Which you would have been back in the day, most of you. And you want a crop. Pick a crop. Wheat, thank you. Okay. So how do you get a wheat crop? You grow it. Well, thank you very much. Spot the townies, right? You plant the seed? Then the birds eat it. What do you got to do first? You got to clear the field. You got to plow the field. You got to harrow the field. Then you plant it, yeah? And then hopefully what happens at the end of that? You've got a wheat crop which you then need to harvest. So whose action is that? Is that our action or God's action? It's both. Yeah? If I have a field, trust me, I've tried. If you just leave a plot of land to its own devices, what do you get? Weeds, thank you very much. You get the odd good thing. And when we first came to the manse, there was the old potato about, which I'm sure was, you know, a relation of all. Apparently, there were tatties grown in that field way, way back in the day. And sometimes some of you will have been in that situation where you've taken down an old building and the plants that were underneath will grow back up, because the seed's been lying dormant. But if you want a certain crop, you've got to prepare the ground and plant the seed and cover over the seed and, you know, maybe feed it a bit every now and then. And then when it's up, if you just leave it, it'll just go to waste. You've got to harvest it. But can you make a seed grow? No. Even when you're at playgroup and you got the cress seed and you put it on the wet cotton wool, you didn't really make it grow. Sorry. That's in the Creator's hands, is it not? So it's a both. How do we cultivate joy in our lives? This is how we cultivate joy in our lives, is that we intentionally do the things that God can then work through. The initiative starts with God. It always does. But then it's our response, our choices that make the difference. So God says to Adam and Eve, you know, you can eat of any fruit in the garden. Just don't eat that stuff. That's the tree of knowledge of good and evil. You don't want it. What do? They succumb to the temptation. Did God say you couldn't eat of any of the fruit of the garden? Big fat lie. They say, oh, well, we only can't eat of that one. Oh, now I'm feeling left out. Oh, look, it's good. Actually, Eve even says we weren't allowed to touch it. God didn't say they weren't allowed to touch it. She's just building a big story for herself. And then she kind of talks herself into failure. We cultivate the fruit of the Spirit by allowing the grace of God to enter into our lives, but then by making good choices on the top of that. All right? So if you are habitually a grumpy curmudgeon, and it might be that you're unaware of this, ask your relatives, then you put yourself in the place of receiving joy by being in God's presence, by trusting Him in times of hardship, by actually seeing it as an important part of overcoming, that kind of resting in His goodness, and the delight and the gratitude and the warfare and the courage that we see in Jesus as He goes to the cross. All of those things build to make us joyful. And when we make those decisions, we sort of say, oh, yeah, I'm going to take this risk, but Father, you're going to need to be there ahead of me. Well, this is really not going to go well. And guess what happens? Guess what happens? So joy is built in our lives as we allow God to work in us and we cooperate with Him. It's both, just like growing a garden. We don't get to sit back and freewheel for discipleship. It's tough work, but it's not a work, if you see what I mean. You get that? It is not entirely contingent on our efforts, and it's not a reward for our efforts. Remember what I said at the start? It starts out in God's grace, but then we respond to it, and He can build into us. Okay. So we've done love as the foundation, and from that rises up joy. Can I just ask, does anybody here reckon they have more capacity to be loving and joyful? Okay, just checking. Now, of course, some of you will be thinking about those amazing Charlie Mackesy pictures, which takes us back to the prodigal, and this incredible verse that is there in the story of the lost coin. Yeah. The same way, says Jesus, having told the parable of the lost sheep, sorry, it's the lost sheep, this one. There is more joy in heaven over one lost sinner who repents and returns to God than over 99 others who are righteous and haven't strayed away. Well, we've got our heads around that, folks. He loves us no matter how busted up we are. That process of loving one another, of helping one another, of knuckling down with one another generates joy in heaven, releases joy on earth. So, I'm going to come, just like we were, I'm loved, therefore I am. The most joy-filled people in the world. Does that make us laugh? With that kind of slightly nervous, no, we're not. And we've all come across Christians who can do fake joy, right? Because some of us have been them. I'm happy on the inside. Joy should flow out of us, because we're loved, folks. All of us are loved. And there's no rejected children in God's family. There's none passed over. And while we might think it by looking at other people's circumstances and getting a bit jealous or whatever it may be, the truth is, He loves us all with all of His love. And because of that, the most joyful people on the earth should be the people that bear His name. And we can be the most joyful people. What about being the most joyful person in your family? You think you can manage that? Some of you are already going, I'm there by a head already. Could we be the most joyful people in our family? Could we? And that we'd be joyful because He is. Oh, wouldn't that be great? Wouldn't that be great? Yeah, I think so. So, joy. Delight is wonderful things we lay hold of. Gratitude that they're there at all. Warfare in that when you go, oh, Jesus, I love you, it crumples demons. And courage to face whatever circumstances we have ahead, whatever challenges. And then as we allow God to work that in us, and this is going to be true of all the fruit, as we respond and make good choices, that unlike the bad choices that our forebears would have made, we have the same weakness. As we make those good choices, so the character of Jesus is built in us. And we overflow with joy. And we can be like Leah, naming our kids, because we're that chuffed at God's goodness. May we pray.